Alistair McLean, Dr. Retro from Secret Design Studio, was one of our most passionate guests, whose love for mid-century modern architecture was a joy to be a part of. We decided to bring back this episode to help those who are looking to buy a mid-century modern home and want to know what to do with it. Have a listen to hear what we loved about this episode.
You're listening to Real Estate Right. Top experts talk about how to buy, sell, rent, and invest right. Your host is Sue Langda.
Over the last 5 to 10 years, there has been a real surge in interest to embrace the character in homes built between 1950 and 1980, especially with those aged in their 30s and 40s. It's a style that makes them reminiscent about their family home or their grandparents' home, but it's also an era that's got the character but without the hefty price tag of a period home of the 1800s to 1930s. Today, we are going to talk about the appeal of the retro and mid-century homes with Dr. Retro himself, an expert architect. Alistair McLean is the principal of Secret Design Studio, focused on mid-century design, including architecture and interiors. Alistair's practice is based in Melbourne, though he helps his clients across Australia with design advice that is in sympathy with their mid-century homes through his Dr. Retro consultations. Welcome, Alistair. How are you today?
Great, thanks, Sue. Lovely to be here.
Thank you for coming in. Now, why did you decide to focus your practice on mid-century and retro designs?
I studied architecture at Sydney University.
Yeah.
And my passion was Australian history and architecture.
Yeah.
I did very well with that.
Yeah.
And I'm always a firm believer that you do what you're passionate about.
Yes.
So I saw an opportunity in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
And about 11 years ago, I left working for a number of big builders and started my own practice, specialising in people who need help, who own these beautiful homes from the post-war years and would like to work with them to make them more comfortable, but in a sympathetic manner.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's the key to it all. Like, there's so many people who do keep the original part of the home and then do something very contemporary and out there at the back. But I think if you create that seamless transition between old and new, I think that's more of a winner than otherwise.
Yes. Yeah. Well, one of the important things about trying to work seamlessly is that it actually works out to be better value in the long term.
Mm.
If you do something that's cutting edge and contemporary today, in 10 years when you're selling the home, often that extension renovation will look a little bit dated.
Yeah. And daggy.
And daggy. Whereas if you work with the style and the age of the renovation can't be picked, it just works beautifully together.
Yeah.
And it's seamless and people aren't saying, oh, it's a 10-year-old renovation. I can tell by the tapware.
Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah. Yes, get that all the time, especially now that there's lots of different coloured types of taps out there at the moment. Yeah. Now, what do you consider the difference between mid-century and mid-century modern?
There's a big difference.
Okay.
Okay. So I actually prefer the term post-war to mid-century.
Okay.
To avoid any confusion between mid-century and mid-century modern.
Okay.
Okay. So in Australia, there were hundreds and thousands of houses built in the 50s and 60s and 70s.
Yes.
Okay. And they were certainly mid-century decades.
Mm-hmm.
But most of those houses wouldn't be defined as mid-century modern.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
The modern part relates to the inspiration and the aesthetic of the home, and it's a home that has been drawn from modernist principles that were developed much earlier in the 20th century from Bauhaus in Germany.
Yes.
So houses that have been derived from modernist principles, you'd define as mid-century modern.
Okay.
Okay. But a lot of houses like your triple-fronted brick veneers, which were built in mid-century decades, would not be defined as mid-century modern, although some of them have got some mid-century modern elements in them, but they're not really derived from modernist principles.
Yeah, okay. So if I saw a cream brick home in the 50s, which had, like, steel windows, sometimes, like, a bit of curved architecture, like, the, you know, in the window spaces, maybe a bit of edge glass windows, a decorative mantle of some sort. Would you consider that mid-century or mid-century modern?
I'm going to throw a wild card and say what you're describing sounds a little bit like it's Art Deco.
Well, I can say, yeah, it's but built in. See, to me, Art Deco is always 1915 to 1945.
Yes,
so I'm talking looking 50s,
yep.
almost hitting okay. 60s. So we've got Art Deco elements.
Yes, yes. So I would not define that as a mid-century modern home.
Okay.
Okay, I'd describe it as a post-war home.
Yeah.
Perhaps with some Art Deco influences.
Okay.
So what's interesting about that period immediately after the war is that we didn't have the same technology and media that we have today.
Yes.
So a lot of Australian builders who were building Art Deco style homes before World War II came back, building started again after World War II, and they kept on going back to what they were doing before the war. And that's where some of those 1950s houses have got an Art Deco influence from.
Yeah, so because, the terrazzo porches and all that sort of stuff.
Yes, and the terrazzo bathrooms. So strictly by decade, it's not an Art Deco home,
no.
but it's a post-war home with some Art Deco influences in it because it's a leftover from before the war.
Yeah, fair enough. What era do you consider to be retro?
Retro is a very vague term.
It is.
It's a really loose term, and that's why I like using it because I've had clients that with houses that run from the 1920s to the 1980s and everything in those six decades. So so it's a very loose term, and it's not an architectural term.
Okay. It's just something
that people use and throw around, and generally it's got a positive feel about it, a feeling of nostalgia, but it doesn't really relate to a period of architecture.
Okay, cool. Just to clear that up. So if I do write that there's a retro, meat safe or something in a 1930s home or something like that, that's okay.
That's fine.
Yeah.
That's fine, yes, because meat safes are retro.
They are. In terms of your clientele, what age group of buyers and clients are keen on buying homes from the 1950s to end of the 70s to renovate.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of these homes are on the market pretty much at land value.
Yes.
So often they're people with smaller budgets.
Mm.
Okay. So I find they fall into two distinct camps.
Yeah.
Generally smaller households.
Yes.
Because these homes don't have a lot of bedrooms, often three bedrooms, sometimes two bedrooms, occasionally four bedrooms, but generally three bedrooms.
Yes.
There are a lot of two-bedroom homes from this period out there, and the reason is that there was a big shortage of building materials after the war, and the government brought in a regulation that only two-bedroom homes could be built.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of two-bedroom homes in the inner western suburbs, which have got quite nice, spacious living and dining areas and two bedrooms.
Mm.
So they're generally smaller households. The houses are generally on bigger blocks.
Yes.
So with that combination, it's really popular. They're really popular with young families with little kids, where there's only generally one open plan living area.
Yes.
And lots of opportunity for
extensions,
but also big garden space for kids to play in. So for small households, young couples, young families.
Yes.
And also I get the other end of the spectrum, the retirees and so forth who want to downsize.
Yes.
They've had their kids. The kids moved out. They don't need a four-bedroom home.
Yeah.
They like to garden. They like to entertain. So a smaller home with a big garden is ideal for them.
Yeah. And also those retirees will probably buy that property knowing that they could possibly subdivide it and keep the original home that they remember as their family home from way back when and then still have land to build something up behind.
At the other end, the people who aren't buying are families where they've got three big teenagers because there's too many people.
Yeah.
Especially when you start to have boyfriends and girlfriends visiting.
Yes.
When you've got one family living area
to
accommodate a large household.
So the see, I find that people in their 30s and 40s are attracted to these kind of homes because it brings back that nostalgia of mum and dad's home or grandma's home.
Grandma's home, yeah.
Yeah.
That's very important.
And they want to put their own spin on that. Without
and these homes speak to them.
Yeah.
And their memories.
Yeah.
Which is a really lovely thing to work with.
Which is
one of the things I come across quite frequently, which is a lovely thing, and every home as kids grow up, people have done use the edge of doors to measure the progress of of kids' heights.
Yes.
Right? So quite often you come across a door that's got the history of the past family living there.
Yeah, nice.
And it's a lovely thing to just to keep as a little bit of an echo of the past.
Yeah.
And I visited a house last week actually where they actually had the growth levels for two or three families that lived over lived in the house over the past 60 years.
Wow. So, Alistair, what elements and structural attributes do buyers love about their homes?
There is a lot. I don't know where to start.
Okay, start.
Okay. Look, a lot of these homes have got a lot of character that you don't see in contemporary builds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very difficult to generalise, but generally they're characterised by a really good relationship between the inside and the outside.
Okay.
Lots of big windows with linking to the garden and into transition areas like terraces and decks and so forth, which provide like an outdoor living room to these houses.
Mm.
So that was a really important element that was used a lot.
Yes.
The
old patio. We like the old patio.
Yes. A multifunctional indoor sort of indoor-outdoor transition zone space. And sometimes at the front of the house or the back of the house or the side of the house.
Mm.
Okay. One of the big differences between homes built from this period and today is that a lot of homes today are built to impress from the street.
Mm.
But as soon as you get behind the facade, they're fairly generic.
Yes.
Whereas a lot of mid-century homes have got the reverse of that.
Mm.
They're often very understated from the street.
Yeah.
They don't have a lot of presence.
Mm.
They're often fairly low slung. They've got a lot of established planting at the front.
Yes.
Sometimes a courtyard or a carport.
Yeah.
So they're not making a big showy statement to the street.
Mm.
The charm of these homes comes when you come through the front door and what's actually inside the home.
Yeah.
And often these homes have had more attention, more architecture put and thinking into the inside than how it presents from the street.
That's why I write when it comes to like 50s and 60s, I'm like, oh, wow. You know, it's a spacious surprise. It's something that everything is very surprising when you get inside them.
Yeah.
From the humble exterior to
And that's what I say to my clients. I say, you know, are you building your home to impress the Uber Eats delivery driver who only gets as far as your front door?
Yeah.
Or are you building it to have a lovely interior that's a good place to be?
Yeah.
That the Uber Eats driver's never going to see.
Yes. Well, you know, and at the same time, the burglars think that, wow, let's look at this awesome house.
Yeah.
There's got to be something good inside. Or are they going to go, nah, that's pretty boring, let's move on to the next?
Do burglars think about the style of the house, or do they just take the opportunity, they don't really care what it looks like?
Oh, I don't know. I've never been a burglar. I just... But do you know what I mean? Like... It's more what's accessible, I guess.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you make it so it's less accessible, then they're less
likely. So they have an understated charm from the street.
They do.
And a lot of people don't like to be showy like to have it as an understated secret.
Yes.
With privacy.
Yeah. And it makes it their sanctuary.
Yes.
All good. Okay. So where does a new owner start with a renovation to a mid-century modern home?
Okay. Well, I think the most important part is don't rush, do your research.
Yes.
Okay. I suggest to clients, I have a lot of clients who have just purchased a mid-century home.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I've got a merchant builder client who's booked me in for January and they're not settling until the 14th.
Yes.
And they booked me in for the 17th of January because they just want to get started.
Yes.
So my advice to those people is you must live in the home for at least 12 months to understand how it works.
Yes.
What works for you, what works for family, what doesn't work, rather than ripping into it straight away.
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of these homes have got aging infrastructure.
Mm.
And when you buy a new home, you've often got a limited budget with the work you can do.
Yes.
So there's no point in putting a new kitchen in, a new bathroom, painting it throughout if the roof's leaking, if you need new stormwater pipes.
Or the stumps.
Or the stumps have gone, things like that.
Mm.
So understand the home so you can budget for the boring infrastructure stuff before you start spending money on the pretty stuff.
Yes.
And the pretty stuff is really exciting.
Yeah.
And people get very passionate and involved with it.
They do.
But there's no point in spending money on something when you've got a limited budget, when more serious stuff needs the attention.
Yeah, because there's nothing worse than water dripping on your brand new stove.
Exactly.
The worst house I've ever seen was the kitchen floor was so rotted that the kitchen cabinets were actually sitting on the dirt.
It wasn't
livable.
Okay.
But, you know, these things can happen if you don't look after the structural side first.
Yeah. The other thing about these homes is that it was a really exciting period of architecture where there was a whole lot of new building materials and technologies available.
Yeah.
And there was a building shortage. So architects were often trying to do more with less.
Mm.
Okay. So it means that quite often these houses, these experimental things have not aged well over 60 years and so forth and do need remedial work.
Are you talking about like the wallpaper and in the shelves of the cupboards?
I'm talking about things like putting vinyl tile floors in wet areas.
Yeah.
Okay, well, quite often bathrooms had vinyl tile floors and sometimes the vinyl tiles had asbestos in. And what as a result of that, they're not waterproof.
Yes.
So, but they were cheaper than ceramic tiles.
Yes.
So as a result of that, the timber floorboards and joists have rotted out.
Yeah.
It's a really common thing.
Yeah.
Sure. But the best example I can think of architects being clever to stretch building materials is Robin Boyd with his window wall.
Mm.
So Robin Boyd is an Australian architect of the time, and he really wanted to work designing cost-effective architect-designed homes that were very available for people that weren't wealthy.
Yeah.
And one of his innovations he did was working with Stegbar Windows, who are still in business today, with the development of the window wall.
Mm-hmm.
So prior to that, people, when they built a house, they built a wall and put a hole in it and put a window in it. So what he developed was a window frame that was actually structural and supported the roof.
Okay.
So as a result of that, you could have a long wall full of windows.
Yeah.
The frame is holding up the roof.
Yeah.
And you didn't have boring walls and what you could have wonderful garden aspects and things.
And you don't have, you know, expensive labour and bricklaying and you don't have.
Yeah, because the frame of the window is holding up the roof. Yeah.
Yeah.
So innovations like that were very clever and an example of pushing the boundaries of what could be done.
Yeah. Well, Robin Boyd's family is all around Murrumbina. So there's Boyd Park in Murrumbina.
Yep.
And there's a family home still standing in that little pocket there. So if you ever want to go check out some Boyd properties, out that way. Okay, now we recently saw on the block that a Neil Clarahan designed home was renovated, trying to be in keeping with the architect's original vision. Which architects could fetch premium?
That's a really good question. A lot of architects work geographically.
Yeah.
So they were popular in one area, but relatively unknown in other areas.
Yes.
So, for instance, Mornington Peninsula, Chancellor and Patrick did a lot of homes.
Mm-hmm.
They were very well regarded and they were sort of inspired and derived from the Frank Lloyd Wright school. So if you like Frank Lloyd Wright, have a look for Chancellor Patrick Home because there is a connection, an inspiration, and a link between those.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Probably Australia-wide, the biggest name in the business would be Harry Seidler.
Yeah.
Okay. He was really the father of the international modern movement in Australia as far as residential homes go, with his Rose Seidler house in Wurrunga.
Mm-hmm.
That was his first home he did in Australia for his mother, and nothing else like it had been built before.
Yes.
The family has held on to that home, and it's now part of Sydney Living Museums.
Oh, wow.
It's in Wurrunga.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in Sydney, look up the Rose Seidler home, it's open, I think it's every second weekend, but check the website.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a wonderful example of conservation where the house has been reinstated down to the furniture and the appliances as it was originally built.
Mm.
So that's a great example of conservation.
Yeah.
It probably wouldn't be very practical and comfortable to live in today as far as our standards and requirements go, but it is a beautiful, beautiful home to visit. But he's the biggest name.
Yes.
part of the reason for the value of his properties is that the Seidler family monitor very closely the real estate listings.
Yes.
So if anybody claims a home to be a Seidler home, then it's not a Seidler home. Their family is straight onto it.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
And kicks up a fuss.
I'm sure they would.
But also, they are very aware of people who have owned Seidler homes and have engaged lesser architects and draftspeople to do renovations and extensions. Yeah. So if the home has had some radical changes and it's no longer easily identifiable as the original design,
And
then it's advertised as a Seidler design,
They'll
be kicking up a stink with the agent saying, well, it no longer qualifies to be a Seidler design because it's so far from the original.
Yes.
Okay. Mm. So he's probably the top level, and because of his international reputation, and there's a lot of cachet owning a Seidler home if it's an original condition or sympathetic to the original home.
Yeah.
So that's probably the biggest gun out there.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of architects out there who did homes for people that weren't the wealthy.
Yes.
And did a lot of them. So, for instance, Ken Woolley, who's a Sydney architect, He was engaged by project home builders Pennett and Sebbett.
Mm-hmm.
Pennett and Sebbett did about 3,000 homes in the 60s and 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And his design, one of his designs was a split-level home.
Yeah.
So it was ideally suited for split-level blocks.
Yes.
And those homes still stand the test of time.
Yeah, nice.
In the Sydney School style. Because of the success of Pennett and Sebbett, There are a lot of other lesser builders who tried to imitate the style of split-level homes.
Mm.
So quite often a real estate agent may attribute a split-level home to being a Pennett and Sebbett, where in fact it's not.
See, I would say a Pennett and Sebbett-inspired home.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be a better way of doing it rather than claiming it's to be Pennett and Sebbett.
Yeah.
We mentioned Robin Boyd.
Yes.
Robin Boyd was an architect involved in the Age's Small Home Service.
Mm-hmm.
And how that worked is the Age newspaper used to publish a small design for a compact, affordable, architect-designed home once a week in the newspaper. If you were looking to build that home, you could then purchase the working drawings through the service. They had a limited number of plans available, so you had to sort of be in quick.
Yes.
As a result of that, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of homes from the Small Home Service built around Melbourne.
Yeah.
And other cities did similar things as well.
Wow.
So you don't have to be spending multi-million dollars to get a home by a name architect.
Yes.
And a lot of these houses, the vendors often don't realise who the designer was.
Mm.
And that's really important. I think it's in the vendor's interest to find out as much about the house.
Yes.
The best example I can think of is I had some clients in Ringwood East and they fell in love with this mid-century home and the agent was promoting it as a Robin Boyd home.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of Robin Boyd homes out there.
Yeah.
They purchased the home. They managed to, they went to council and got the plans.
Yes.
And, of course, the plans say who the original architect was.
Mm.
The original architect was, in fact, not Robin Boyd, but another architect, Annabelle Kagan, who is a much higher-profile architect.
Yeah.
And didn't do a lot of houses out in that direction. He did a lot of houses in Kew and things like that. So if the vendor had known that who the actual architect was and the agent had promoted it with that original architect's name, then they might have attracted much bigger buyers from Kew, who particularly liked his style of architecture, rather than people who weren't particularly interested in architecture. And so they got it for a good price, but the vendor could have perhaps got a lot more if they'd have known the history of the home.
Yeah, so it definitely pays.
Definitely pays to find out.
Yeah.
And the best way to do that is quite often people leave the plans when the vendors. Previous event owners might have had the plans.
Yes.
Or going to council and making inquiries there.
Yeah.
A lot of councils have archives and you pay a fee and they'll pull out a copy of the original plans and then you'll have proof of who it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I'm spending millions of dollars buying a piece of art, and it's being claimed it's done by a particular artist,
yeah,
I would like some provenance and proof that the piece I'm being purchasing is from that artist. And it's the same with buying a home that is promoted to be designed by a certain architect.
Yeah.
The word of mouth is not good enough.
No.
You really need some sort of documentation.
Yeah.
I helped a client who is looking at a Robin Boyd home in Templestowe.
Yeah.
That was being promoted as a Robin Boyd home, and she liked Robin Boyd, and she wanted to buy a Robin Boyd home.
Yeah.
And the agent was saying it's a Robin Boyd home, and advertised it at.
Yeah.
So I did a bit of digging. I said, well, where's the proof? Where's the documentation? Yeah. Oh, the lady next door, her aunt said,
yeah,
you know, and that's not good enough.
No. Yeah.
Really. When you're spending big dollars.
It's not. Like, I know when I write ads, for instance, I will dig up the deeper knowledge and find out more and just, it's what needs to be done. Like I've seen a lot of copywriters who just don't, and I just think, oh, this house deserves so much more than what you're giving it. Why are you saying it needs to be demolished? No, it's a beautiful example of architecture. We're going to have a short break and come back with more from Alistair McLean from Secret Design Studio, and he will talk to us more about the actual renovation process when it comes to mid-century, modern and retro homes. You're listening to Real Estate Right, and we are talking to Alistair McLean from the Secret Design Studio about the appeal of mid-century modern and retro homes. Now, Alistair, which Melbourne suburbs attract buyers wanting to maintain the integrity of a mid-century or retro home?
Probably the biggest and best known is Beaumaris.
Yes.
Probably second would be Blackburn and Kew.
Okay.
And the reason why those areas are so popular is that at the time that they were developed, a lot of architects were wanting to build their own homes, and they were suburbs that they often chose. Okay.
Yeah. So Blackburn Lake would have been quite
a lot of mid-century homes around that area.
Beaumaris is just, it was like the holiday home, you know, resort of the south.
But it was still affordable real estate. Yeah. You know, architects don't earn a lot of money.
No.
And that at the time was an affordable proposition for a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely. Now, do you find that owners of mid-century modern homes like to do some sympathetic renovations but also put their 21st century twist on it?
I try to steer them not to be too cutting edge and contemporary when they're doing their renovations, because that style of work, you know, it's very fleeting.
Yes.
It looks wonderful on your Instagram feed.
Yes.
But in 10 years' time, that look is going to date.
Yes.
And that's the way the building industry works. It's very much a fashion industry, as you can see by things like The Block.
Yeah.
They encourage people that they need to renovate their bathrooms every 10 years or kitchens every 10 years to keep up with the latest look.
Yeah.
In fact, these rooms are quite functional.
Yes.
And that's why I say if you work in sympathy with existing architecture, it's never going to look dated. It's just going to look right in the house.
Yeah.
Okay. If you go into a period home that's had a kitchen that's 20 years old, it looks really dated. It looks wrong. It looks stranded. It looks wrong in that house.
Mm. Unless you do something that's, as you said, sympathetic.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So you see a lot of, like, in the old Victorian and Edwardian homes, you'll see that whole French provincial kind of kitchen, which, you know, with their farmhouse sinks and the big overstudded, you know, tapware and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's in keeping with that period feel. And as you said, it's timeless.
Yeah.
Whereas with a mid-century modern home, it's hard to sort of, like, transition from what it was to what would work now.
Not really, because those homes are built on modernist principles.
Yeah, so, I get
providing
that.
You work with a kitchen that's based on modernist principles.
But it's not as
or a bathroom
renowned, like, in an easy trade. Like, you'd have to have somebody like yourself show them that this is possible. Yeah. This is, you know, how we can have those modernist principles in your home.
Yeah. So it's not a matter of being working like the roadside of the house as far as conservation.
Mm.
But it's a matter of being sympathetic to what you've got.
Yes.
And not trying to introduce a new style.
Mm.
So you don't put your Hampton-style kitchen in your mid-century home because you like Hampton-style. If you like Hampton-style, you buy a Hampton's house.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. I'm with you with that one. I see a lot of things which are, oh, my God, why would you do that?
I have a special name for that.
Yeah?
It's called WTF style.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, Alistair, I didn't expect that from you. Now, we've got a listener question here. Of course, Leanne from Beaumaris is going through the planning stages of renovating her mid-century modern home and wants to know, can an unsympathetic renovation devalue her mid-century home?
Yes. It can. Okay. It all depends on the extent of it.
Yeah.
But a lot of my clients are actually trying to repair the mistakes of the past.
Are they?
So when you've got a 60-year-old house, it's often had a number of renovations over its 60 years. Yeah. Okay. Sometimes these houses are onto their second or third kitchen or bathroom. Some dubious choices have been made along the way.
Yeah.
Okay. So it can definitely devalue your home. If it's, you know, overwhelming, or as I said, in the WTF style.
Yes.
Which
is really the 90s, I've got no personality style.
Yeah. Or postmodern sort of style. Where you're bringing things, materials and elements that are completely alien to the style of a home.
Yeah.
So things like your postmodern, your glass brick and your curved walls and your red granite bench tops with your apricot cabinet work and your brass handles and things like that.
But we like a bit of salmon and peach, no?
Yes. And they just look wrong. But quite often, you know, sometimes those elements haven't been introduced cheaply, and they're a quality build, and that's why the challenge is for people who are buying these homes, because aesthetically some of these elements which may work perfectly just look wrong, but it's hard to justify ripping out something that looks so wrong purely on aesthetic grounds when you've got a tight budget.
Yeah.
So I've got people that, you know, that live with their kitchens and bathrooms they hate because they still function perfectly, they don't look right, and it's hard to justify spending money just for an aesthetic point of view.
Now, why is it important to enlist an architect who understands your vision when it comes to renovating these homes?
That's a really good question. Mm-hmm. And I'd say it's actually more important to engage an architect or designer who understands the home and that you can work with.
Yeah.
Because sometimes your vision might not be appropriate for the home.
Yeah.
And one of the important things with these homes is to understand the concept of custodianship.
Mm.
Versus ownership.
Okay.
So these homes have been around for 60 years or so or more, and they've had a number of households and families in that time, sometimes a few, sometimes a lot.
Yeah.
Most people tend to stay in their homes 10, 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you've got something that's a little bit special, right, then, and you're hoping, you know, and your home is special enough that it might be around, you know, to be 100, right? Then by you imposing your vision for the 10 to 12 years that you're going to be there may not be the best thing for the longevity
of the home.
of that structure.
Yeah.
When it's sold and people don't like your vision.
Mm.
And that's why getting somebody who understands and can read a house and work with your vision to steer it and tailor it to maybe not match your vision exactly, but meet what you need.
Yes.
And also not be detrimental to the house. Yeah. Really
so
important.
Basically meeting your functionality, the functionality that you need.
Yeah.
But in a style that's complementary.
And we go back to the Hamptons style kitchen example again.
Yeah.
You know, if I had a client that said, oh, I bought this beautiful mid-century home by, you know, it's done by Robin Boyd. Yeah. I love Hampton style. I want to put a Hampton style kitchen in.
Yeah,
you know?
I've always dreamed of having a Hampton-style kitchen.
I'd say, well, look, that's your vision, but is it really right for the long-term future of the house? Because as soon as you put the Hampton-style kitchen in, it means that your future potential buyers who do like Robin Boyd and do like mid-century homes aren't going to consider buying your house because of this kitchen that's just wrong with it.
Yeah, because they'll look at the Hampton style kitchen as being very gaudy and very...
It's not understated like the style of the house is. So so that's why sometimes your vision may not be the right vision, or maybe a few amendments and refinements and steering it could be, but...
Yeah.
But
that's why you need somebody like you.
That understands the house and understands the heritage and the history of the home.
Yeah. Now, I'm a big one for using repurposed materials. Where can buyers source recycled materials to add to the integrity of the home?
Okay. You have to be really, really careful about what you use.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many dangers in recycled materials.
Okay.
You've got to be very, very careful. So today we have much more stringent regulations regarding building materials as far as risk to human life and safety.
Yeah.
So a lot of materials actually aren't suited to be reused.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because they've got the asbestos element.
They've got asbestos in them or lots of lead paint.
Yeah.
One of the classic things I see is big glass doors.
Yes.
So we now have regulations as far as the glass that's used in glass doors and windows adjacent to glass doors has to have a certain impact resistance and be quite safe.
Yeah.
That if you run through it or something like that, you're not going to cut an artery. Mm. It'll be like windscreen glass in a car.
Yeah.
Whereas the old doors that you buy don't have just got normal glass. Often it's quite thin.
Yes.
So they're actually quite dangerous to use to reuse a door. And some of these doors have got, you know, beautiful etchings and things like that on. So it's a real pity that you really, by the regulations, can't use those sort of things.
But if you wanted to, like, get some Tassie Oak floorboards and you just want to extend that, you know, back, you know, section or whatever,
The two places I recommend.
Yeah.
One of them is the Eco Group in Clayton.
Yes.
And what they do is they reuse bricks and pavers.
Yeah.
So they're involved in demolition.
Mm-hmm.
And they will demolish a house and source the bricks, which they'll clean up, take all the mortar off.
Yes.
Put it on pallets.
Yeah.
Okay. And these bricks can then be reused, whether for paving or for new brickwork.
Mm-hmm.
One of the beauty of using old bricks is that they're generally about 20% cheaper than new bricks.
Yes.
And they've got quite a lot of character to them.
Yeah.
So they feel aged. There's a patina to them, which is quite lovely to work with.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of the new bricks, especially the cheaper bricks out there, are fairly
stock standard,
bland as well.
Mm.
So definitely Eco Group in Clayton.
Yes.
They've got a big brickyard.
Yeah.
And they're good also for colour matching. So if you're trying to match existing brickwork, they're a good source for doing that.
And you might even get one with a little stamp on it saying the Olympics 1956 on them.
Yep. You might.
You might.
You might, if you're lucky. The important thing is that bricks are very hard to match because they vary a lot depending on where they were quarried, which brickwork, when they were fired and so forth.
I've got a good story about that. I'll tell you in a second.
So that, they're the people I go for bricks and pavers.
Yeah.
The other place is Renovators Paradise in Keysborough.
Mm-hmm.
And they are also linked in with demolishers. I think it's Hughes Demolition. So they have a history of demolishing large and palatial expensive homes in the inner eastern suburbs.
Oh.
And they try to reuse as much of the stuff there, the floorboards and windows and things like that. So so that's a really good resource. They've got a huge warehouse and a whole mixture of different styles, you know, Victorian, Edwardian, and a bit of mid-century stuff as well.
Yeah, sounds good. Why is it important to recognise that this architecture is actually an historic period in terms of how Melbourne transformed throughout the years?
Okay. Well, the post-war years were the most exciting period for Australian architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A whole lot of reasons. Primary one is that we were having a building boom, a post-war building boom, where thousands of houses were built.
Yes.
But at the same time we're having this post-war building boom, there was a great sense of optimism and the future.
Yes.
So it was a really exciting time
and
a positive time. We had a lot of new building materials becoming available and new building technologies.
Yeah.
We also had an influx of architects and craftsmen coming in from Europe. after the war, and quite a lot of architects that some had trained at Bauhaus and so forth, or been inspired by that, were bringing in a new way of thinking about houses and design into Australia.
Yeah.
The other big change is that before the war, a lot of Australian design architecture was inspired by what was happening in England.
Mm.
After the war, our influence very much came from America.
Yes.
And they were doing lots of big, exciting things in America, which we drew on.
Yes.
So a combination of all those factors working together makes it a really exciting period, a unique period.
Yeah.
And there was experimentation, and while there was still a shortage of building materials, architects were trying to do more with less.
Yes.
And I spoke about the Robin Boyd window wall.
Yes.
Stegbar. So things like that, which are very exciting, were being pushed out there and experimented on. People weren't afraid to use colour.
No.
Okay. So some really
psychedelic stuff out there.
Well, not quite psychedelic, but really bold colours.
Yeah.
Which people are scared of colour today. People don't understand colour.
No.
So it's all white or off-white or greyish, you know. A lot of houses have very dynamic colour schemes. Mm. The other thing is that natural materials such as timber and stone were plentiful.
Yes.
So there was lots of stained timber. I love this.
And stone
stuff. And face stonework.
Flagstones coming
plus back. Plus we had, time. You know, relatively cheap labour. Mm. So there were the craftsmen available to work with those materials.
Yes.
Today we've got the reverse situation.
Yeah.
That the craftsmen who are skilled and talented enough to lay a crazy pave are few and far between.
Yes.
And they charge an arm and a leg.
Yeah.
Whereas after the war there were lots of people from Europe who could do that well.
Yeah.
And materials today are relatively cheap. And available compared to COVID.
Yes.
prior to what the wars, after the war.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you so much for coming into the studios, Alistair. It's been a real pleasure having you on. Now, how can Real Estate Right listeners get in contact with you?
Probably the best thing is to visit my website.
Yep.
Which www.secretdesignstudio.com.
Yes.
I've got an inquiry form on that, so they can just fill that out with their request details.
Yes.
I generally book up about 2 weeks in advance, but at the moment I've got a lot of demand, so it's sometimes a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
If they'd like to book in a personal Dr. Retro house call,
yes,
which is a 2-hour consultation in your home,
yes,
please contact me. Outside Melbourne, I'm doing my Dr. Retro virtual visits,
okay,
which is a 1-hour Zoom consultation. So I can cover the whole of Australia with that, providing you've got a good internet connection.
Yep, sounds good. Thanks again, Alistair. We'll have your details in our show notes on our social media.
Next week, we are back with brand new episodes for 2023. We start with property entrepreneur Chris Christoffi from Reventon, who will talk to us about why you should buy an investment property before you buy your first home. Chris is passionate about helping people on their real estate investment journey and explains to us about rentvesting and how it's changing the mindset of Australians when it comes to property ownership. Don't miss it!